So the biggest challenge was the fact that I didn't actually have a decision point about slides versus an actual demo. Oh, I'm live. Oh, wow. Hi. So I was just telling these folks up here. I actually didn't. I was trying to make a decision about whether I was going to be doing live demos for V6, so sort of the practical side, versus doing slides. So one of the interesting things that you run into is when you do a practical demo, you have nothing to take home, right? So I sit here, I demo everything, and unless you're taking like photographs of everything that I'm doing or I snapshot everything, it's really tough to have good information. So what I tried to do is actually provide more slides with content. Unfortunately, the deck that's actually up to download on the site stripped out all my comment sections that are actually in the slides. So what I'll do is I'll actually make sure that I'll put up on my blog the actual full deck that has all the material that's in it afterwards that actually has like practical configs. How many folks work in Cisco shops? You run Cisco network shops? Okay, so I actually have like practical router config files that actually have like how V6 stuff works and what I set up to match or correspond with the actual client portions of what I have in the slide portion. Hopefully you'll find that useful. This isn't starting yet. I'm just blabbering. Hope that's okay. How many folks, the expectation on the V6 side is to get first-time practical hands-on knowledge about V6? You don't know anything about it. No one knows anything about it. I'm assuming most of the folks don't know anything about V6. Okay. How many people have deployed Windows 8, Server 2008 R2, done Windows 7, anything newer? All right. Congratulations, you all deployed V6. All right. So that's one of the things you need to realize is that V6 is on by default. How many folks actually took the effort to actually disable IPv6? How many folks actually think you actually disabled IPv6? Do you really, really think you disabled IPv6? How many folks have read Joe Davies' book, Understanding IPv6? Joe's book, Understanding IPv6? All right, so that third edition is coming out in the end of June, 1st of July. Everyone should be ordering that book. Number one, because I was a technical editor for the book. So I want O'Reilly to understand that they actually spent the right sort of money to get me to actually review the thing. Number two was the fact that it really has some very good practical information in it in regards to when you think you're disabling IPv6, what actually is disabled, okay? And understanding what's happening in the network stack. It's not stuff I'm going to be covering in the session because the reality is there's not enough time to cover all that in the session in terms of doing the disabling components. I've hidden a bunch of the slides in this deck versus the one that you guys can download. The reason why is because there's 90 slides. There's no way I'm going to get through 90 slides in the amount of time that we're talking. That being said, it's in there as reference material for you to go ahead and take a look back at. So you pretty much have to download the slides if you want to get all the information that I'm actually providing. And I guess, how close are we on time? Should I be starting? 2 minutes? Do you actually want me to wait 2 minutes? You want me to get going and make everyone else suffer who didn't make it in? Didn't get here early enough, didn't grab enough coffee? Let me tell you, this is killing me. I'm a West Coast guy, all right? Getting up this morning, hardest part was getting up yesterday morning, make the keynote and check in and get my speaker badge and all that good stuff, you know, and then drinking beers with everyone the night before and then realizing I didn't get to bed till 3 in the morning and waking up at 6:30 in the morning. So hopefully my presentation's a little better because I spent the time beforehand. Luckily, I know the content. How many folks actually are familiar and really spent time with V6 and done deployments, direct access deployments with V6, things of that nature? Get your hands up high so I could see. Okay, what are you doing in my session? You want to understand what you did? That's a good reason. Why don't we go ahead and get started? This is the IPv6 bootcamp, getting up to speed quickly. My goal is to try and make it so that you have some practical understanding about IPv6, so you're not scared of it. Most of you are scared of it. Put your hands up if you're not scared of it. Liar. All right. So you're scared of it, you have no idea what you're doing with it. You're wondering why it's running around on your network and you have no idea what's going on. So I wanted to talk quickly about what's driving IPv6. I'm a wanderer, by the way. I have a tendency to wander around, so hope that's okay. What's driving IPv6? What's driving IPv6 is a couple things that are happening in the industry. Industry-wide, worldwide. The biggest one is this one right here. It's the depletion of IPv4. I'm assuming most of you have heard about the fact that that IANA has depleted the IPv4 address pool. This happened in February last year. This is probably the biggest reason that most people are talking about V6 today. So you're in the Asia-Pac region, the reality is you've run out of addresses. They're assigning only V6 addressing and very small amounts of V4. And if you want to do business, have business continuity with folks that are in that region, you're going to need to deploy V6. Key reasons people are adopting it, direct access for Microsoft Enterprise. If you're interested in direct access, you're going to need to learn V6. Audit and security compliance. This is the interesting one. How many folks actually have regular PCI, SOCs, things of that, SAS 70? So a lot of times they're going to be asking you questions about, do you understand everything that's running on your network? If you're checking yes, and you're running V6, and you don't know anything about it, and you're not doing anything about it, you just lied. Okay? And then ability to provide effective, unlimited number of IP addresses. This is turning into a bigger issue for much larger, bigger corporations. Comcast, for instance, Comcast actually ran out of 10-dot addressing space for their internal net, if you can believe that. Okay? So they actually have overlapping 10-dot addressing space that they have to NAT for. That's an ugly situation they're in. And the rapid growth of cloud services that really require elastic compute, flexible addressing. V6 gives you that unlimited sort of addressing configuration. Very useful for that. V6, how do we get started? It's really sort of the next generation internet protocol. It's much larger than V4, so covering V4, it's 2 to the 32nd. It's about 4.3 billion is what you hear as the number. V6 is 128-bit. It's 2 to the 128th. So this is typically referred to as 340 undecillion addresses. It's a lot of addresses, okay? This is a ridiculously huge amount of addressing space, and it's actually very hard to fathom the numbers. It's what we say now, and it's actually quite true. You could do some things to actually blow up your addressing block, but the reality is that it's a practically infinitely large addressing block to work with. V6, it's enabled by default in Windows. I'm hoping most of you get this as a pick the head up sort of notice. It's enabled by default, and it's going to be used first. And you've likely already deployed it. You just didn't know it, right? So if you're doing Windows 7, Server 2008 R2, and you didn't explicitly go in and go through all the painful effort to disable V6, you already have V6 running in your network. Congratulations, you successfully deployed V6. You all feel better about it? Go ahead and holler questions, it's fine, if you want. So what does it look like? We're starting off, I'm actually giving you real V6 addressings here. This is a compressed format address, so we're allowed to compress addresses, zeros. Just allows us to shrink them. Continuous zeros we're allowed to shrink, that's what's indicated. That's the second one. And then this one's actually a link local address. Anytime you see the FE80, that is a link local that stays on a local subnet, a local VLAN that it would be corresponding to. And then it actually has this little percent 13 after it. That's sort of interesting. We'll cover that a little later. Practical. These are real configs. This is actually from my gear at home. Going to cover the V6 address portion. Nice short thing. Quickly, for everyone to understand how the addressing portion works, we use colons to designate between the address, sort of just to break it up. We also use, as you noticed here, hex notation. So all your addresses are in hex. How many people are fluent in hex? Do it all day long, right? So I have trouble with this, so you're going to have to bust out your calculator to go back and forth between binary portions and hex and decimal and everything else. One of the other things that you need to sort of pay attention to or note quickly is that how many folks are doing IP address management in spreadsheets today? Are we doing it in spreadsheets? Yeah, you'll notice that spreadsheets don't actually convert from hex. They consider that just a regular character, right? So there's one of the challenges you're going to be running into is don't expect to have any auto-configuration for addressing that work in a spreadsheet. Considering the fact that /64 is a standard subnet in IPv6, I challenge you to be able to fit 18 million trillion addresses in a spreadsheet. So I challenge you on the being able to do the addressing plan that way anyway. All right. So one of the notations and a common reference you're going to see is a nibble. It's four bytes. And it's really sort of represented as one space out of the four that are indicated here. So if we rotate that two, we actually we're just changing the natural nibble boundary for V6. Nibble boundary is something that's commonly being used for actually subnetting. And that's why it's important to sort of reference it here. So let's talk about the address types. Unicast. Unicast is the address type that you're already used to in V4. It's no different for V6. It's a single interface. It's a unique host-to-host communication method. It's the most common thing that you're going to see is unicast. Multicast. Multicast is exactly the way you are used to seeing it and being used in V4 world. How many folks have multicast deployments? Okay. You're going to have more multicast deployments with V6. Okay. Zero more interfaces on one or more hosts. So that just means you're going to have multicast everywhere. What is broadcast? There is no broadcast in V6. Broadcast just happens to be the multicast address scope that says, hey, everyone on the network, pay attention. That's all broadcast is, right? So multicast, that's all we have in V6. And then the last one is Anycast. How many folks are actually doing Anycast in V4? It's actually sort of practical and very useful. You're going to see more implementations of Anycast in V6. And this is the one where you actually have multiple interfaces on one or more hosts. Anycast is a special purpose unicast address. You actually can't tell the difference between a unicast address and an Anycast address because they look exactly the same. So good luck identifying it in the wild. It's actually something that you have to define. So let's cover the unicast types. Global unicast address, this is actually from the first block that IANA has allocated out. It's defined in these RFCs. 2000:3. It's only a small fraction of the total global addressable space that's available. This should last us a good period of time. Link local, remember if I mentioned that FE80:64 defines a link local address that stays on the local subnet. Never leaves, routers won't pass it, it's there just to stay there. Okay? You're always going to be able to identify it by that FE80. Unique local addresses, or ULA, is a special class of addresses that's supposed to be sort of like the equivalent of like RFC 1918, but not really. Typically, you want to avoid it if you can. And that's FC00:7, but the usable space that most people start with is actually FD. So you're going to see FD for unique local. Special addresses, your unspecified address is :, and your loopback is ::1, far easier than that 127.0.0.1 that you're used to. So it's ::1. And then we have the transition addresses, your 6-to-4, ISOTAP, and Teredo. I'm not going to break them out separately. We're going to cover those a little later. Unicast types that have been deprecated, you have site local addresses and IPv6 compatible addresses. I leave this as homework. Pull up Wikipedia. They do a great job covering it. There's a lot of older Microsoft material that actually represents, talks about site local addresses. When you see them talk about that, realize you're reading old material. Ignore it. Site local addresses are not used anymore. Don't use them. It's not something you should be using at all. IPv4 compatible addresses aren't, you're not going to see a lot of reference to that either. Most common ones, global and link local are the two that you're going to see on your hosts on a day-to-day basis. So let's talk quickly about some of them. So this is actually my machine, Windows 7, set up with V6 addresses. These particular represented IPv6 addresses are actually unicast and global. The temporary IPv6 addresses are unicast and global. And then you'll notice that the link local address is unicast and local. Okay, so they're all considered unicast addresses. Two of them are global. One of them is local. Link local is always going to be local. Just sort of makes sense, right? That's going to cover everything that you're going to see on a host side. You're also going to see something on the link local side. It's called a zone ID. It's also called a scope ID. It's represented by this percent and then the ID identifier actually after it, after the V6 address. The reason why is because you can have the same link local address on multiple interfaces corresponding to where that may reside on the other side of the interface. So if you take your computer and plug it in and give it two Ethernet ports, plug it in on a network that has a router, right? The router may actually advertise the same link local address on every single one of its interfaces. So how are you actually able to tell which interface you go and leave to reach that one? The way you do it is by the fact that it actually has the ID after it, so it tells it, well, when you want to talk to that particular one, I recognize that it comes off across this particular interface. I now have an interface ID to tell me which one to stuff that packet payload out of. So that's the reason that that's there. So let's talk about interface ID. The interface ID is the last 64 bits. So out of that 128 bits that we have, the last 64, the lower 64, It's a fixed length. We have a couple different options for how we build this portion. First one's called EUI64. It's a stateless auto configuration. This actually allows majority hosts, and the majority hosts that do EUI64 are actually Linux and OS X machines. So if you're running OS X machines in your environment, Apple, or you're running Linux boxes, you're going to see EUI64 addresses running around. You're also going to see temporary addresses, stateless auto configuration, and you're going to see stateful auto configuration, which is DHCP, and you're going to have manual or static assign. And then we're going to have finally permanent, which is randomly generated. This is how Windows does IPv6. It utilizes permanent, randomly generated, and then it also builds temporary addresses. So the common default behavior for Windows is to use the permanent or randomly generated. Okay. It will get overridden if you decide to use stateful DHCP v6. So that's the exception. So if you actually deploy DHCP v6 in a stateful manner, we'll cover that here in a bit, you won't get a permanent address. You'll still actually do a temporary address. So how do we build EUI64 addresses? We have 48 bits from your MAC address. So your unique MAC address, you have 48 bits. We actually split it apart. We stuff these FFFE bits in the middle. We flip this bit, and suddenly we have a EUI64. So everyone will be able to read this and identify this quickly, right? The moment you look at it. Actually, you will. So it's sort of cool. I actually set up in my demo configuration here. You'll notice out of that address, the way you identify EUI64 is actually to look for, there's your MAC address, and you just look for that FFFE. As soon as you see that, now who's going to? It is possible to fake this out. You can manually go in and set your IPv6 address. And if someone just wants to mess with you, they could stuff in FFFE, and you would think it's a EUI64. How many people are going to go through that effort? Why? So that's how you're going to identify EUI64, and you flip the seventh bit. Let's talk about prefixes. Prefixes are a way we actually identify network segments in V6. So a network prefix such as 2001DB8. By the way, you're going to see this all the time, 2001DB8. The reason you see this is the standard RFC network addressing block for documentation. So when you're doing documentation example configurations, you're always going to see 2001DB8. That's why we all use it in the industry. Saying first portion, that's network, the network portion and the host portion. Sometimes people talk about provider assigned and locally assigned, so I just wanted to give you an idea about how that corresponds on this. The first 64 bits are on the left, on the left-hand side, and the host portion is on the right. That's that ID portion that we were talking about. And then a different network prefix example, this one's just a slash 48. A slash 48 is the most common sort of network class of addressing block that you're going to get in a small organization. I run a slash 48 at home. That's what I get as a network block. Okay? So we have a few bits to play with in there to actually subnet with. So that's what I'm indicating there, is that we actually have 16 bits of subnet space. So I have 65,536 subnets to play with in my slash 48 at home. How many folks think I'm running 65,536 subnets at my house? You'd be wrong. No, I'm just kidding. So it indicates the number of bits that's defined in the network. Okay? That's what's going on there, the slash 48. So subnetting, example of a network prefix, we're doing their slash 48. Here's where this whole nibble boundary thing comes into play here. Remember we talked about nibbles? So when subnetting, you use natural nibble boundaries, count in increments of 4 when selecting subnets. So slash 64 is the smallest subnet you're ever going to allocate. Okay, so on a single VLAN, slash 64 is what you're always going to use. I'm going to repeat that. Pick your head up. You're doing your... This is the one you have to pay attention to. A slash 64, that is the subnet that you're going to use on a local VLAN, a local segment. Point-to-point link, a slash 64. Everyone looks at me crazy and says, you're going to assign 18 million trillion addresses for a point-to-point link when I only need two addresses out of that? Well, my argument is, let's say we have 5,000 machines that are sitting in your Wi-Fi network today, right? Okay, 18 million trillion addresses minus 5,000. 18 million trillion addresses minus 2. Really? You want to argue? Seriously? Use a slash 64. Your life is easier. Okay? So, subnetting, natural nibble boundaries, counting fours, 64, 60, 56, 52. Notice that natural nibble boundary now keeps it at that single number, so we go from 0 to F, 0 to F. And so your life is much easier just realizing that you're counting that way. So here's a slash 48, slash 52, slash 56, slash 60. So these are the natural, easy subnets. So when you need 16 subnets, not 16 hosts, 16 subnets to operate in a particular network, you go ahead and assign out a slash 60. If you need 256, you do a slash 56. If you need more, 52, 48, this is how you would do natural subnetting. There's a whole different section in here that I've hidden on the slides that covers subnetting next thing. My message, count by four. It's a little different than what you're used to doing in V4, so the way you remember this is in V4, the only thing I'm carrying over from V4 to V6 is I count by four. That's it. All right, come on, you guys. Have you noticed anything odd yet? Anything? I just lectured you on this. I told you to pick your head up on it. Why is it always a slash 64, right? You got to be asking, why is the minimum, why is our minimum value size a slash 64? Why are we automatically always on every network assigning the default is 18 million trillion addresses? It's the internet squared in a single VLAN. Are you guys insane? Who came up with this, right? Take the internet, square it. Every host that can fit in the internet today, square it and stick it in a single subnet. How many people think that ARP's going to work really great? Right? Well, they took care of that. There's no ARP in V6. We're going to talk about stateless address auto-configuration, SLAC. That's what it's called, SLAC. If you turn around and tell everyone and you say this whole long stateless address auto-configuration, you're crazy. Just say SLAC. It's SLAC. So they have the... Basically, what's unique is that V6 has the ability to self-assign addressing. How many people are using the automatic assign addressing, the 169? You see that, the 169, 254 stuff that shows up that is like, oh, well, I recognize that we don't have DHCP set up, so you just auto-assigned yourself an address. That's how I know. Your help desk probably deals with that. V6 has the ability to do this out of the gate. It is self-assigns itself an address. So a host uses routers to discover... And basically, it has a router solicitation message. It has a router advertisement that are sent via ICMP v6 that we're going to cover a little later. And we can get information from those pieces of information that are provided by the routers on the network. And basically, it's on-link prefix to the routes. Okay. What it's really giving us, it's giving us what network it belongs to. Okay. And it's allowing us to basically set it up. It requires the prefix to be /64. In order for this auto-addressing component to actually work. That's sort of the trick of it all. So the reason that everything is a slash 64 is the only way that we could do that is to have a standard that everyone could comply to be able to automatically assign addressing. And they chose the natural nibble boundary of slash 64. Okay? If the prefix is smaller than a slash 64, if you use something smaller than a slash 64, none of the hosts can auto-assign addressing. This may not be a problem if you're doing DHCP v6, but if you're not, basically, your machines can't come up and self-assign addresses. So you're breaking the ability of machines to do SLAC. That may or may not be a bad thing, but that being said, here's SLAC only. This is actually a practical configuration. This is the prefix that I built out for the SLAC configuration. This is actually a live one. This is real. There's no global DNS services, and there's no fully qualified domain information. Why would that be? Any idea why that would be? Because the only thing this thing got, right, was a router ID that said, this is the network you're on. That's all it got. All it got was the prefix portion here, right here, right? The router just spent time and actually said, you know, I'm the router, I'm giving you this piece of information right there, right? But there's no global DNS. There's no fully qualified domain info. It's like, what the heck do I do with this? It's pretty much useless, right? I've got a route, that's it. The good thing is that if you're using V4 and you get a V4 address, you can look up DNS still, right? So you still have DNS capabilities to look up on the V4 side, and you still get your fully qualified domain name from the V4 side, so that's not too bad. So the reality is you could still do lookups, and you could still resolve a quad A record for V6 and still be able to connect using your V6 interface. So this isn't such a horrible thing, right? You can get up to speed very quickly and start using it. Usually what this means is that you have SLAC, and the host lacks any sort of DNS server info. Okay, so it has no way of natively in V6 looking up DNS information. It usually also indicates a poorly implemented deployment of V6. Usually means someone went in and just turned Slack on and turned V6 on to try it out, and your computer came up and said, "Woohoo! I got V6," and started using it. Okay, usually indicates that you don't have something set up correctly. Okay, so let's walk through auto configuration. There are multiple ways to do auto config. Slack is the first one. Okay, so the first one we talked about is Slack. That's how you auto config. Second one is stateful DHCP v6. Okay, so stateful configuration is DHCP v6 stateful. Then you can do both, and that's DHCP v6 stateless. Are we all confused now? You have Slack, you have DHCP v6 stateful, and you have DHCP v6 stateless. What in the world is all that, right? So the router advertisement actually includes flags in it. It actually has flags. The router sent out flags. The autonomous flag, the A flag, right? Think of the A flag as autonomous, set yourself up, auto-configure yourself. Autonomous flag, auto-configure yourself, okay? Managed address configuration flag, an M flag. An M flag means you're a managed host. That's gonna be DHCP v6 stateful. I'm managing you. I would say something inappropriate about that one, but either way, you're a managed device, okay? This is gonna be enterprise deployment. This is what you want to pick if you're an enterprise deployment, okay? Other stateful configurations, O flag. This means, hey, we're really cool. We're gonna give you the autonomous flag. You can go ahead and self-assign yourself an address. And we'll just be kind enough to hand you a DNS server and maybe, if you want to, a fully qualified domain name to use, to append, okay? So it's other. It's doing the other thing, the weird thing. So DHCP v6, here's the RFC. It has both stateful and stateless configurations that we just went through, okay? So DHCP v6 servers assign the IPv6 address in stateful configuration. I am managing you, I'm telling you what address you're gonna get, just like you do in v4 today. Most folks in v4 today, you may set up a pool of address range that it can do, but you're still telling it what address it gets, right? That's the way you set up DHCP v4 today, even though we don't call it v4. The RA has the M and the O flag set. The A flag may or may not be set, okay? So we have the M and the O flag that are set. We're managed and we're other. So what are we giving you? I'm giving you your address, and the other flag is giving you DNS and maybe some other things like NTP or maybe a TFTP server, something else unique, right? That's the other flag component. I'm telling you, come get some more information from me, the other pieces of information you need besides your address, okay? All your options are going to come from here, except for your default gateway. So this is unique. In V4 today, you set what the default gateway is in DHCP. In V6, you do not do that. V6 has Slack, it has auto-assigning. The router takes care of telling and announcing where the default gateway is on the local network. Does anyone see a problem with that? Anyone think about that one? Think about one real quick. Pardon me? If you're connected to multiple routers, right, they can advertise multiple RAs, which one do you choose as your default? So there are actually flag bits that your network team needs to set about who's the owner of a particular RA on a particular subnet. The other bad thing that happens with this one, how many people have ever seen Windows machines that are actually set up with internet connection sharing? Woohoo! Right? Set up internet connection sharing. The moment you turn that on a local network, so I take my Windows 7 box and I plug it in and I turn on internet connection sharing, and I have V6 set up on my box, guess what I do? That little flag does. It turns me into an RA. I start actually advertising RAs on the network. Guess what that means to everyone who's on my local network? I've got a prefix, I'm advertising an RA, I have the A bit set. What are you all gonna do? You're gonna slack an address, you have V4, so you can look up DNS, and you look up a quad A record, and it gives you a V6 address, and you wanna connect to it. What's gonna happen next? It's gonna use me as a router. Is that like the ultimate man in the middle attack or what? All right? So I just took all your traffic and stuffed it through me, and you had no idea, okay? I was actually gonna test this on the Wi-Fi network here locally, but I didn't wanna get in trouble, so. It's actually possible to do this. There's features in your networking stacks. Cisco has something called RA Guard. Juniper has some specific access list to build to control which ports, okay, which ports on your network actually are allowed to advertise RAs. Something if you're on the network team, you really need to pay attention to, okay? So all the options are gonna come from DHCP v6 except for the default gateway. So what's stateless? Basically, you're gonna use the DHCP server for all the options only, DNS, NTP, all the other stuff, but it's not gonna get its address from there, okay? So you're not setting up addressing pools or anything else of that nature. You're just providing other info. The RA only has the O flag. You're still gonna have the A flag set because the machine locally needs to still get auto-assign itself an address. A, auto-assign. O, other. M, managed. Okay. A-O-N. Have a cheer with that one. So Windows-specific autoconfig. By default, Windows is going to generate a random interface ID for non-temporary autoconfig addresses. This is that permanent condition I talked about. Okay? That's what it's going to do. So the funny thing is Windows isn't doing EUI 64. Can anyone think of a reason why it wouldn't do EUI 64? Why would Microsoft go through all this hassle of making your machine capable of doing EUI 64 and then not using it? Their coders were really bored, right? The guys in the network team, Abilotti and the rest of the crew, they were like, when we're making this, we just want to do extra work. Is that it? How many people think that was it? Come on, you guys. No. So the reason we do that is EUI 64 has your MAC address in it. Let's say I take my machine, my wireless interface, unique MAC address, EUI 64, I'm only doing bit stuffing. FFFE inside my MAC address. I take that, I'm on one network. I roam to another network. I slack. I use EUI 64. The last 64 bits are the same. They're the same, right? I now travel to a different network. You're watching me jump from Google when I'm on Google's campus, and then I move over to Microsoft's campus, and you can see me at Microsoft campus, and then I move over to a different location, and you can follow me. Anyone see a problem with that? As a consultant, it's a little bit of a concern for me because I don't want to be identified in every single network I go to, although if you're using cookies on a web browser, it's all done anyway, right? You don't have any control over that. But that was one of the principal reasons. Security, okay? Security was the principal reason. It's not utilized. So the host basically builds a random ID, randomly generates its last 64. So the last 64 is randomly generated in Windows. It starts using it right away. So this is slightly different than EUI 64. It doesn't wait for a duplicate address detection process to happen. So not going to cover a lot of duplicate address detection. Let's just say there is a stateful way in v6 to determine on the network whether someone else has my same address or not. Okay? When would you run into this? Well, if you actually run into this occasionally, you get the old school conflicts with multiple MAC addresses from all the same manufacturer because they did the same burn-in chip because they're a cheap shop, ran like 6,000 of the same chip type on the board, you might actually have a case where you have the same hardware MAC address, you could run into that issue. Duplicate address detection is very quick. It's not something you usually have to worry about. Auto configuration is used to build link local and can be used for global and ULA depending on the flags, the A, M, and O flags. So depending on what you have set for that subnet, well, it's going to determine that. You can run multiple prefixes on the same subnet. So ULA, global, and link local, each one of them with permanent, temporary, or slack addresses. Needless to say, dealing with the total number of v6 addresses that you might have on a particular interface can become overwhelming. Okay? Slack and DHCP v6 with the O flag. This is that funny little configuration we're going to walk through. So in this particular prefix, we're going to get a permanent and a temporary. For this prefix, we're also going to get a permanent temporary. What's interesting about this configuration from a network standpoint is that the router only has this particular prefix set up on its actual interface. How many folks are used to seeing that on v4, where you actually have a network that's actually set up and being utilized, but the default gateway on the router interface isn't actually in that network? Has anyone actually seen that before? Sort of unique, right? So I can advertise a prefix in DHCP v6, make it available in the local scoping of the local VLAN, and operationally get it working. And the way that this actually all works is because of the fact that Link Local is utilized for the next hop to send traffic out. Link Local is utilized as the next hop to get traffic out. So it allows you to do that sort of, I can build a fake subnet or a subnet that doesn't actually have a routed interface in the router available. So one of the biggest challenges out of all this, as I've just spoken, is that you can have multiple subnets, ULA, global, link local, Slack, DHCP, stateless, or stateful, or configuration of all of them, for every interface on every host in your entire network. How many people want to manage all those addresses? Yeah? I don't have a lot of fun with it either. This is where IP address management actually comes in. So everyone was curious about why IPAM made it into Server 2012, right? This is one of the reasons why, okay? One of the reasons why was for cloud management service. The other one was the fact that who the heck can keep track of all these addresses on the V6 side of the equation? Spreadsheets don't work anymore, people. It's not gonna work in any reasonable size organization. You can't make it work. Start using tools for this stuff, okay? It's normal for a host to have three or more IPv6 addresses. Each /64 can have 18 million trillion addresses. I really don't think you want to do this in a spreadsheet anymore, okay? And in hex, all right? That's where the IPAM solution. I don't care what vendor you use. You can use Infoblox, BlueCat. You can use SolarWinds. You can use, I mean, there's tons of vendors who are doing this. Go get a tool to do this. Microsoft gave you one in Server 2012. It's going to be coming out for everyone to use on that. Just use a tool. One of the things I didn't cover in great detail is ICMP. There's a little bit more in the deck, that stuff that I've hidden you want to go ahead and reference. One of the things that's key and critical in ICMP v6 that's different than v4, and this is the area where you want to pick your head up, folks, is the path MTU. Path MTU is really important in v6. Why? Why is it really important? There's no fragmentation in v6. Let me repeat this. There's no fragmentation. There's no packet fragmentation in v6. Your router can't break apart a packet for you and reassemble it into smaller chunks at the far end for you. That doesn't happen anymore. V6 has a fixed header size. Has a fixed header size, okay? No fragmentation occurs in V6. Let me repeat that. No fragmentation occurs in V6. So path MTU is really important because this is how we determine whether we're gonna have fragmentation. Because if we have fragmentation, guess what? V6 isn't gonna work, right? So first path MTU. My router then identifies a link that maybe has an MTU that's smaller, 1400. It then sends a packet payload back that says, hey, guess what? You need to set yourself down to 1400. Okay, set yourself down to 1400. Next one comes through, I'm 1400, I'm still good, right? No problem. This one's MTU 1500, I'm still good, and I'm able to deliver a payload to the other side. If you turn ICMP V6 off or block it, guess what's gonna happen? You can't do this process. If you can't do that process, guess what you can't do? You can't talk to the other host. This breaks the internet. Do not break the internet. All right? Everyone who goes to their firewall and says, deny every single piece of ICMP traffic, your firewall rules are broken. Let me repeat that. Your firewall rules are broken. It may work for V4. It will not work for V6. Okay, so anyone who thinks you can carte blanche, pick up my firewall rules, run them over here to V6 and put them in place and say, woohoo, everything's gonna work. No, it's not. Okay, you're gonna break things. Path MTU must be allowed or V6 will break. Can't say this enough. And this means you need to allow it through your network, through your firewalls. What's a firewall, everyone? A firewall is a router that is broken. Okay, that is what a firewall is. Firewall is a router that is broken, okay? You're talking to a routing guy up here, right? So that's what a firewall is. Stateful firewalls are really important. I think they have their place. The reality is, my statement's true. It's exactly what it is. You need to allow ICMP v6 traffic through. I'm not saying you have to allow all ICMP v6 traffic, but I give you a little homework, all right? IPv6 DNS. DNS, you have a quad A record now for v6. Quad A, where in the world did we come up with this, right? The PTR zone is ip6.arpa. So instead of inaddress.arpa, for your reverse, you're gonna have ip aaa.arpa. Okay? Why is it AAA? Why is it a quad A? A in V4 represents 32 bits. We can all do math, I hope. 128 bits, we have four A's. Woohoo! I just solved the big mystery of the universe in DNS. Okay? So that's what you got there, all right? Reverse DNS. We're going to cover this quickly here because I want to make sure we have enough time. Reverse entry in IP6 ARPA looks like this. All right? Wow. Doesn't that look convenient? You all want to type this by hand, right? Everyone make sure you get every single zero. Because you're missing one, you have the wrong inverse record. Every nibble must be included. So zero compression has to be expanded back out. So that's what I'm showing you there. And then leading zeros have to be added back in. Needless to say, how many folks want to manually manage your in-address record zone? Yeah, this is where the tools come in, right? How many people think you can auto-build a zone anymore? Remember in DNS, if you're used to doing bind, you can auto-zone, pre-build a zone, pre-populate all your PTR records, right, to build them out? 18 million trillion of that. You can't build a database big enough to hold it. You're not going to create this stuff on the fly, right, in terms of auto-generating that. You have to auto-generate everything with a tool. The tool has to basically go in, have this record, and then build this discrete record, okay? So how do we get DNS in Windows clients? DNS servers are tamed via DHCPv6 with the O or the M flag, right? So you're going to have that O and M flag combo, that other flag that's going to tell me my DNS server info. And because more than likely you're running DHCPv6, you're going to have the M flag set because you actually want to have a managed address on that device. If there's no DHCPv6, then DNS basically has to be manually configured. How many folks are running OS X or Linux in their shop? Okay, the first comment you're going to get from all the OS X guys, okay, because I get this every single time, they're like, well, how come you aren't running RFC 6106? And my first reply back is, because no one else supports RFC 6106. So go stuff it. So the reality is, no one else supports it. There's no way to actually do it. You have to run a specialty host machine on every subnet to give them RFC 6106. How many people want to set that up? Sounds like a joy, doesn't it? Just to be able to provide them DNS info. It's like, just get a real DHCPv6 client in your machine. All right? So same thing's true on the Linux side. I pick on them. I run plenty of Apple devices too. So what am I telling you now? It's time to move to the future, folks. V6 is it. No looking back. All right, I gave you the basics. Let's go over some of what is the real crux about why you're here. You want to know why you're doing what you're doing with V6 and where you want to go. So we have up here really quickly native IPv6. And I've got some solutions down below it. Dual stack, this is where the majority you're going to fit, right dead center in the middle. And then we have tunneling and we have translation. Okay, let's go over these. Our transition technologies are the bottom portion. Transition, we're transitioning to V6. In 2 years, we'll all be running V6 and only V6. All right, I get it. So transition technology, tunneling, dual stack, and translation. Let's go over dual stack. This is where you guys all are going to be tomorrow. You run IPv6 and IPv4 side by side. And you let the host decide which protocol to use. That's the way to do it. For routing, the two protocols operate like ship in the night. They are completely independent. How many folks used to run IPX networks with IPv4 at the same time? OK, you're old. And besides that, Apple Talk and IPv4 at the same time, right? All those, remember those multi-protocol all on the network at the same time sort of situation? That's what V4 and V6 are. They're two separate protocols. You need C3PO. You need a protocol converter. All right? They're two different protocols. They're running your network. You're going to consume more resources to do dual stack. We're in a transition period, I hate to tell you. You're going to use more. If you're doing V6 only, you'd be more efficient. If you're doing V4 only, you're more efficient. Dual stack, I'm using both. I'm going to use more resources automatically. Okay? Just going to tell you that up front. For those router jockeys in the room, more TCAM, more memory, things like that are going to happen on your routing table. Okay? And you have to understand how your applications behave. This is really important. How many folks do QA and testing for app components in their network. No one does QA? Really? Dang. We just set it and go? Woohoo! All right, so if you're doing QA, you really need to understand how your apps perform. Why? Because they may do something different on V4 versus V6. Or maybe the app isn't V4 capable, and so it's only going to do V6? Okay, whatever. Okay, so it's V4 only, maybe not doing V6. You need to know. You need to know how your apps are going to behave. So Windows 8, Server 2012 have RFC 6555 implemented? Sort of. It's called Happy Eyeballs. How many folks have actually heard any of the articles about Happy Eyeballs? Nothing about Happy Eyeballs? Come on. So this is all an initiative by Dan Wing and Andrew Yegoff over at Cisco to sort of help with the transition components of a failure mechanism between V4 and V6. Okay? And the failure conditions are the fact that if you're using V6 by default first, you might run into a weird situation where it takes you like 2 to 6 minutes to fail over to V4. How many folks want to wait 6 minutes on their browser? All right. Well, that's why this came out. So all applications are going to benefit from this being implemented in Windows 8 and Server 2012. How many folks are on Windows 7? You all get to move to Windows 8 to take advantage of this. Go start on your deployment right now. You have to use RFC 3484 and RFC 6555 and the Internet Update draft of RFC 3484 to determine your app behavior. So for those of you in the QA group, this is really important. Those of you that are dev, this is really important. You need to understand how your apps are going to behave as they move through the network stack. You need to understand what this behavior is. There's your references. Dual stack is a transition technology. The eventual goal is only IPv6. Can't repeat this enough. Your eventual goal is only IPv6. Okay? How many people will achieve it in their lifetime? How many people want to retire before they have to do this? All right. So. Tunneling. Let's talk about tunneling. In Windows, there are three main tunneling transition technologies. They are... Oh, come on. Some people said they knew some of this stuff in here. Teredo. There's 6-to-4. Someone was complaining about this earlier. There's Isotap. How many folks have read the direct access deployment IPDs? They talk about Isotap. That's evil. And then Teredo. So all of these enable IPv6 to IPv6 communication. They just happen to use IPv4 as a tunneling, as a transport mechanism to build their tunnels. Okay? So V4 is a transport mechanism for the V6 to V6 tunnel transition that we're doing. This is no different than how you tunnel any other thing. If you wanted to tunnel IPX over IPv4 today, what would you do? You build a GRE tunnel, stuff it across, right? Same sort of thing that we're doing here. I recommend turning off all the transition tunneling technologies to avoid any problems you're going to have troubleshooting IPv6. All right. So pick your heads up. Those of you that are typing, pick your heads up. I recommend turning off transition tunneling technologies. Okay? So why? Why in the world would I recommend this? Unless you've actually taken the effort to design a solution to use them, why would you leave them on? Okay? They introduce unpredictable behavior in your client app and in your client machine. So why would you leave them on? Unless you have designed a solution specifically to use them. What am I not saying? Still leave V6 on. Turn the transition technology, tunneling solutions, off. Okay? You're going to have less things that you have to do later in terms of touching your systems. How many folks want to touch their client machine 6 or 7 times in order to set up V6? Yeah, I don't either, right? I want to do the right thing, so I want to turn the transition technologies off. But I want to leave V6 enabled so that when my network team comes through and says, guess what, we've got our core uplifted, we're ready to turn on client access, let's code test with the server team, everything's ready to go, let's turn on V6, let's light it, guess what, it's just going to work. And it's going to work the way you expect it to work because you tested it, but you didn't have to go and touch all your client machines again to turn V6 back on. You spent all this effort, right, to go and touch your host just to turn the transition technologies off. That's what you want to do. You don't want to have to go touch them again just to turn V6 back on. So let's talk about translation. Translation is C3PO, right? C-3PO, robots to human voice or whatever else. It's a protocol converter. We have NAT64 and DNS64. Additional enterprise transition technologies that you should know about, SLB64 and MPTV6. So what do? They do V6 to V4 translation. Think of them as a proxy, that protocol converter. NAT64, DNS64, and SLB64 fit in this category, okay? NAT64 and DNS64 and SLB64 fit in this category. The reason, there's a lot of other translation technologies that are available. And if you're on the network team, you're gonna hear about 6RD and DS Lite and tons of other ways to do this. It's all designed for service providers. Jettison out of your head. There's gonna be a few enterprise use cases, not very many. And if you get to that point, you need to be in a way more advanced class than this one, okay? These are gonna be built in. The NAT64, DNS64 is built into Server 2012. Server 2012 will give you NAT64, DNS64. If you want to run it on Server 2008 R2, you need forefront UAG, okay? SLB64, how many folks are running F5, A10, Citrix NetScalers, things of that nature? You're going to get SLB64 out of that. What does that provide you? It provides you a V6 interface, a VIP, a virtual IP that you can run load balancing to on the V6 world, and they can talk to the V4 resources behind. How are big service providers like Yahoo and Google and everyone else turning up V6 so quickly for World V6 Day, World V6 launch? The way they did that, they went out, got their V6 internet edge turned up, stood up a bunch of VIPs in the V6 world, and pointed in their V4 resources on the inside. And bam, all your content's enabled on V6. Pretty slick, eh? So that's what that gives you. You could do the same thing. You can turn up any server in your environment and make it available this way. Primarily if it's a web resource, it's the easiest, okay? So SLB64 is an option for you on that. NAT64, DNS64 is about being able to do this with some funky little spoofing. And then MPTV6 performs limited prefix only NAT. So one of the things I forgot to mention in the beginning is in IPv6, there is no NAT. How many folks are excited about that? There's no NAT. What is the purpose of NAT? To piss me off, that's what the purpose of NAT is. So the purpose of NAT, right, network address translation, was all about address conservation. It's all about address conservation. Anyone wants to argue with me about security, we'll settle that now. You're wrong. All right? NAT is not about security. If you have any doubts about it, you ever start looking up stuff about STUN and some of the other NAT traversal technologies. NAT provides you no security, except through a little bit of obscurity, okay? It was all about address conservation. When we were panicking about running out of too much V4, we came up with NAT. Solved a lot of problems, made a lot of problems too, right? End-to-end, how many folks are trying to do end-to-end communications with SIP? NAT is no fun, all right? Those that have spent hours and hours debugging and looking at more packet traces I care to think about. In V6, there is no NAT. MPTV6 just broke that rule, okay? There's a good reason it's out there. Dan Wing has a really good presentation on it. I leave it as homework, okay? For MPTV6, there's some use cases. Your homework's really easy. You can go to my blog. I have a write-up about it. So NAT64 DNS server, let's talk about what's actually in Windows. Windows Server 2008 R2 with forefront UAG is capable of doing NAT64 and DNS64. 2012, same thing, it's built in. It basically allows a V6 host to access a V4 host through a NAT64 device that proxies the session, okay? It proxies the session on behalf of. And DNS64 basically does the part of synthesizing an A record. So if you're a V4-only host, you're a server, and you're a direct access client, and the only way you have to get back into the network is via V6, and you have this nice V4 device, and it can only be V4, you can run that direct access client through a DNS64, NAT64. The DNS server is going to synthesize an A record for that V4 resource, so it's going to build on the fly an A record and provide that to the V6 client and say, you want to connect to this IP address. The IP address it's providing is the one that happens to be on the NAT64 device. And that 6.4 device has that IPv4 information embedded in it, because we have tons of space in v6 to do whatever we want. We stuff it in there, goes in, it proxies, connects to the v4 resource, and comes back and translates it. So let's talk about native IPv6. Migration, we want to move away from tunneling, we want to move away from translation, and we want to go to dual stack. Why? There's less effort in debugging dual stack than there is in doing translation or tunneling. There's less effort in debugging the situation for tunneling and translation when you're in dual stack. In dual stack, that means we can natively talk v6 from one side to the other. That means in dual stack, our network is dual stack. It means our hosts are dual stack. It means our servers are dual stack. It means our firewall is dual stack. It means we're connected to the IPv6 public internet. Dual stack, end to end. That's your goal, right, for today. Eventually, you want to move from dual stack to just native. That means we turn IPv4 off. How many people shudder at the thought of turning IPv4 off? Just shudder at the thought, right? And then you actually put in translation as needed for older IPv6-only hosts. How many people, there's ways of actually isolating out IPv4 and running IPv4 on only host networks and using NAT64 and DNS64 to get to them. And then putting SLB64 to allow the reverse. There are translation mechanisms to put in play. But you would actually end up putting in those in play for V4 instead of V6. So that's sort of the big picture. We want to move from tunneling to dual stack. We want to move from translation to dual stack. And then we eventually want to move from dual stack to native IPv6. You have 6 months. Go make it happen. Planning and design. I think the biggest question I get when I'm consulting out on sites is, how do I plan IPv6 projects? It's so huge. V4 is everywhere. It's everything that we do, right? How do I get V6 turned on? I mean, that's an insane project. It's everything. I mean, it's everything. That's the comment I hear all the time. It's everything. It's like, no, it's just like any other IT project, right? Thing I caveat, don't use your V4 design rules for V6. Okay? And I have a separate slide deck I'm happy to share out about some of this and why that's the case. The reality is there's no sparse allocation in V4 rule set that translates to V6. You have 18 million trillion addresses in a subnet. How many people need to reserve and conserve addresses? How many people want to bother? Okay, change your thought process. It's all about subnetting now. It's just about subnetting. It's not about worrying about how many bits you have for a particular VLAN anymore. Do I need a /29? Do I need a /28? Do I need a /27? Jettison, bump, it's a /64, I'm done. Spend your brain power on more effective things. How to subnet your network correctly, right? Build a lab. You're going to need it. Why are we going to need a lab? Oh, come on, you guys. Why do we need a lab? You need a test. Absolutely, you need a test. You need a test. Why do you need a test? Because V6 is on by default, and it's preferred. Pick your head up on this one. It's on by default from Windows Vista on up, right? It's on by default. Server 2008, I didn't say R2, I said 2008, on up, it's on by default, and it's preferred. If I get a choice about using V4 or V6, which one do I use? V6. If I get a chance to talk to my neighbor via V6 and I have link local addressing, which is auto-assigned, right? And I can find my neighbor because he registers himself in DNS, how am I going to talk to my neighbor? Via V6. I'm not going to talk to him with V4. How many folks run Exchange in the edge transport role? Right? The recommendation IPDs. Check your machines and see if they're talking to each other with V6 when they exchange traffic back and forth. You'd be surprised. Okay? Be surprised. So test and understand your software, and that's the key important part. You need to understand whether your software and your third-party apps are actually supporting V6 properly, what they're doing, or some of them that do some really weird things where they do hybrid, where part of the time they're talking V4 and part of the time they're talking V6. Figure that one out, right? And suddenly you're having to combine two different protocol analyses to figure out what the heck your application is doing because one side's using V4, the other side's using V6. Does a DNS lookup with V4 but then actually connects and uses V6 to actually do the socket connect. It's like, so you're going to have to start putting together more regimen testing plans for what you want to do. And make sure you have the same SLA for V6 as V4. Biggest mistake I see people make is they say, all right, we're gung-ho, we're going to get V6 going, got it up on our internet edge. Oh, we can only do tunneling with something. And they don't have the same SLA on V6 as they have as V4. They didn't get it native on the transport side with their service provider. They didn't go through the effort to really work with their network team to make sure that they had high availability in the same way. Okay? Remember, your clients are going to use V6 first. Your clients are going to use V6 first. Your V6 router fails because you don't have high availability. What happened? You just broke every single one of your people. Every single client desktop machine is going to have to stall and fail out on V6 on the default gateway before it goes back to V4. Make sure your SLA on V6 is the same as it is in V4. On the deployment start with forgiving applications. What's a forgiving app? What's a forgiving app? Shout them out. Forgiving app. Web server? Okay. What was that? I don't know. Anything that you think of? Browser traffic, maybe. How many folks are running torrent? Torrent's a great one to test, right? You want to break all your internal torrent folks anyway, right? So I say DNS and SMTP versus web services. Why do I say that? Any idea? Because DNS and SMTP fail back to V4 very gracefully because they do it in the app layer. Less things to worry about. Web services tier, you're going to have to wait for the whole timeout to fail back to V6. Right? It's less real time, too. So you're going to need to understand your dual stack behavior, transition technology behavior, impact on your hardware, software, do the heavy lifting in your lab. Okay? Is that clear enough? All right. So caveats and notes. It's going to use 64 if it has a public V4 address. If your domain join box, you don't have to worry about this. Make sure you add V6 prefixes to your AD sites and services, sites and subnets. How many folks do that for V4 today? Your practice should be doing that for V6 too. Windows does not support RFC 6106. Remember when I told everyone on the Mac OS X side to, well, there you go. And it has a native DHCP V6 client. Mac OS X Lion has a native DHCP V6 client. Okay. It's enabled by default. It's preferred. We already hit this. Direct access. IPv6 is required for direct access. There are two OS deployments that are optional and you can set up. It's the first one with forefront UAG to get the NAT64 DNS64. Second one is basically to set up server 2012. It has NAT64 and DNS64 built in. The first iteration of DA requires that the DA client needs to be able to reach the host that it's going to talk to via V6. If you have NAT64 and DNS64, that's no longer the case. That's why I'm saying you have two options. That way you don't have to turn up the core portion of your network, all your servers and hosts on the inside of your corporate network, for the direct access clients to be able to reach it. Hope that makes sense. So DA clients still use IPv6, but they can use the NAT64 to talk to the V4-only resource hosts. You can utilize all the transition technologies. And remember what I said? You turn off the transition technologies when you don't have a use case. Here's your use case. This is when you would turn them on and do something specific. Direct access is specifically designing it. It's the main transport method because DNS64 and NAT64 is available. Your internal servers no longer have to run V6. Am I saying don't plan on V6? No. I'm saying you can deploy direct access today, be able to get use of direct access today, and still have a V4 core of services. Are you eventually going to turn on a V6? Heck yeah, you are. That's the thing that you're here for. So, we're going to have an IPv6 DA client. We're trying to get an IPv6 server because you've already set that up because you're way ahead of me. We have an IPv6 and IPv4 tunnel, and we have a dual stack network. We have IPv4, and unfortunately, that poor DA client can't talk to our IPv6 server down here. Can't do it. So when the IPv6 host, it can receive and get that file off there no problem, won't be able to do it off the IPv4 host. And That's the end case condition for where you're at with direct access. With 2012 and NAT64, DNAT64, same sort of configuration setup. We have that IPv6 and IPv4 tunnel, but we turned on NAT64, DNAT64 on our DA server, and we're able to talk native v6. We have an IPv4 server that's set up. We have a dual stack network, and we have this fancy NAT64, DNAT64. Look at that. It's sexy too, huh? There we go. The v6 file is able to get to that v6 client, and look at that. Our v4 file is able to go through there, bang, and off to the v6. Okay? So on a design deployment, that's what you're going to get. Okay? Exchange, 2007, 2010, it's going to prefer IPv6 on the same subnet for traffic. Even if you only have static IPv4 addresses configured because of that link local goodness that you have, you likely didn't even notice unless you actually disabled IPv6. Okay? And a few folks have mentioned that they are doing that. Exchange edge transport role is a special IPv6 use case. If you're running a DMZ with public IPv4, you're more than likely actually running and using 6-to-4. You just don't know it. That's where not turning that transition technology off means that your exchange server is doing something funny that you weren't really aware of. Okay? So if someone published a quad A record and you have your edge transport role is not domain joined, you set it up as in the IPDs, you just chose to say, leave it as a standalone box. It's edge transport role. It happens to have a public V4 IP address because a lot of DMZs do that. It's actually going to attempt to use 6-to-4 and connect to the IPv6 internet over that V4 address that you have and use a tunneling technology to go out and talk to that V6 resource. And it will work. That's what's even more alarming to certain people, especially people who have compliance things that go on that they need to actually identify information in that packet payload. So that's one of the things you need to be aware of. Okay? So you might see some traffic there. Make sure your advanced firewall's on. Test all your exchange for V4 and V6 together. And make sure if you're load balancing for your exchange stuff in V4, you're going to want to do the same thing in V6. IPDs, how many folks use the IPDs? Should be something you guys are actually referencing, right? Planning design guides. If you don't know about them, go look them up. They don't currently call out anything separate for V6. When you read them, there's nothing specific about V4 or V6 in them. My understanding is they're actually going to start creating the IPDs with V6 specific information in them. In the meantime, you're going to have to sort of determine on your own the ramifications. I have some information I can provide for some of that. How many folks know this? When they test their software, they don't test it in IPv4-only networks anymore. In fact, they don't even know what the use case in IPv4-only networks are. Is that a little alarming to folks in the room? Nothing you can do about it. They're Microsoft. Join the bandwagon. Okay? Get up to speed. You need to get V6 deployed. They standardize on dual-stack support. There's only a handful of products that have been delayed on the V6 side. Forefront TMG. I'm not even going to go into the politics about this one. All right? Link. And Windows Phone 7. Okay? Windows Phone 7 actually has it in it. It was an issue with the hardware manufacturers all supporting on their chipsets, so they left it off for now. Link, the reason why for Link is actually has to do with the SIP protocol. And SIP protocol, when the first iteration of OCS was coming out, did not have any V6 support, so it made no sense for them to spend time on the feature release for that to put V6 support in. It has it in terms of fields, but it doesn't have it in terms of backend support. So anecdotal information about Microsoft support cases. Some of the biggest red cases that Microsoft has on support have to do with production environments where part of a team goes in and disables IPv6 and breaks their production network. It's like a tier one case, all right? It's like network down emergency. My exchange does not work anymore. I can't do something anymore. That's the biggest use case of trouble tickets that Microsoft is seeing today. They want to reduce the number. Deploy IPv6, it will reduce their number of support cases, right? Make sure you have a test plan, and make sure you test everything in your lab. So you need to go through all the use case scenarios. Don't randomly turn it off in your production environment. If it's running already, learn about it, figure out what it's doing. Don't go the other way and turn it off. You may be calling Microsoft for a support case if that's happening to you, okay? So let's cover happy eyeballs really quickly. This is actually the use case where a client machine, and this is the full happy eyeballs implementation, I just want to give it to you. The client sends both V6 and V4 at the same time. If there's V6 working, it goes with it. If it doesn't work, it has a big delay, then IPv4 is used. Seems to make sense, right? This is to sort of reduce the delay time for a browser. So a browser will send both packet payloads at the same moment. If it gets a reply back on V6, it's going to go ahead and use V6. If it gets a significant delay on V6 or it gets really long latency on V6, it would then use V4 because it's getting a better response time. So it's trying to improve the end user experience, typically for browsing. This is what is actually implemented fully in OS X. And Microsoft chose to not implement it that way. They make use of the same process, but they actually make use of network connectivity status indicator. Everyone know what that is? That's a funny little thing in the lower right that pops up and says, you might need to have, you know, if you're on a guest Wi-Fi, you might need to log in to guest Wi-Fi access, or you actually have internet access. And it pops up and tells you. It's actually using the same component to tell you if you have V6 access. The way they do that is they do it with the same test that they use for V4. That same test is actually saying, hey, I can reach a V6 resource like Microsoft. And that's how it's doing the test. It can modify the cache table. So they've done sorting improvements for the routing table. They do periodic rechecks to make sure that your V6 is still up and operational. All applications are going to benefit from this. And this is in Windows 8 and Server 2012. That everyone understands that when I say the networking stack is actually done by COSD, the Core Operating System Development Team. And it's actually handed to the Windows 8 team, to the client team, and to the server team, just so there's understanding. So all the features that I'm primarily talking about in network are done by COSD. Questions? Someone has to have a question.
How do you ping?
How do I ping? You ping. All the tools are the same. They don't recognize the difference between V6 and V4. So when you type ping, I can actually demo this at the end. Let me just bring up quickly. Significant events. These just happened June 6th, launch of IPv6. Yahoo, Facebook, Google, Bing, Xbox, Windows updates are all V6 enabled. All right? This was from the IPv6 world launch day, you know? And if you want, yeah, there's Bing, there's Xbox, all contributing in. I leave this in here for your own joy of figuring out what to do because you can hit that. Here's the related content. There's going to be another session on Thursday. There's my session. And let's see here. Track resources. This is stuff I didn't get to build, so this is my first time seeing it too. All right. Oh, yeah, Springboard. Springboard is a great location to be able to get information on client. So definitely do that. Oh, yeah, and let's not forget that we have to tell everyone to download the release preview. And the resources. And if anyone wants to see an actual hands-on demo, I actually have my lab, my box set up. Did folks want to stick around really quickly just to see what it looks like on an actual machine?
Yeah.
All right. You guys are braver than me. Let's see here. Switch, VGA2. Oh, thank you. Oh, please fill out the surveys. If it's not a 5, don't fill out the survey. Just kidding. So let's see if I could still, I have a tunnel broker set up. Let's see if it actually comes up here. I may have been idle for too long. Yeah, hold on a sec. So if you're interested in wanting to play around at all, there's some fun little utilities available that are out there. So GoGoNet has a GoGo 6 service, and it actually has the GoGo client utility. So GoGoNet is they provide free internet IPv6 tunnel broker service, and that's what this client actually does. And you can see you can disconnect from that service offering. It'll indicate that it's disconnected. I can reconnect. And I'm actually just on the free Wi-Fi here. And then if you come to the advanced tab, it actually shows that we're doing a tunnel mode of IPv6 and IPv4 tunnels. I'm actually connected all the way up to Montreal. And it indicates that I'm actually advertising on our wireless network, a /64 prefix. Let's see. And there I go. So I'm actually able to ping a v6 resource. Notice the command's not any different. It's still just ping, right? It's still just traceroute, right? It's going to do the same behavior, okay? Probably should have done that without the name resolution portion. Anyway, so you could see some examples of just how the native tool portion works. Let's take a look at my crazy interface and see what the heck it looks like. I got lots of interfaces on here, folks. So here's our wireless LAN adapter. And here you can see the actual IPv6 address that I actually obtained. And here you can see the two, okay, the two that are here. So the top one was my actual tunneled interface that the client actually assigned to me to have as a fixed interface. The other two are actually in that prefix subnet that I'm actually advertising out. Okay, I had that little button to advertise out a /48, so all my friends on the wireless network could all join and tunnel through me. And then I have a temporary address that is actually set up in that same prefix. Okay, so I slack my address and I sort of assign myself a permanent address. So my permanent address is the one that I permanently build, right? It's the one that's just sort of randomly generated. And then a temporary address is actually what Microsoft uses to roll over for your outbound session connects. So your outbound session connects are actually temporary addresses. They're just temporarily set up, they're used for a few hours, and then they go away, and you just generate a new one. And it's used to sort of hide you on your outbound sessions. Does anyone see this as a nightmare for compliance? So that's why you want to do DHCP v6 stateful, because then it's a managed address on the interface. So that's why you want to do that. And then the link local address you could see is the one that's built out. This is only used on my link local interface, and notice now it's a 14, which indicates it's my tunnel interface, as opposed to the 13 that I had before. So different interfaces utilizing for that link local address. Okay? And I got a wonderful 172.28. Man, I mean, V4 looks like a cakewalk in the park now for memorizing addresses versus V6, right? Just an absolute cakewalk. So all the resources are the same. One of the things that you can do, I'm gonna bring up Chrome because just to have fun with Microsoft. So one of the things that you could do, you can use, I happen to be the co-chair for the California IPv6 Task Force. If you're turtle swimming, you're on V6. If the turtle's not swimming, you're not on V6. It's the simplest test in the world. This is a hats off to Kami.net. It was the first site launched on V6 commercially. It was in Japan. It was a huge effort. This was way back in like 1998, 99. It's that old. And it will provide you your V6 address or your V4 address, depending on where you're connecting from. It's dual stacked for this particular one. And it just so happens that I happen to be involved with the North American V6 Task Force. And guess what? The site looks remarkably similar. Look, same resources available. Imagine that. So the North American one's going to aggregate all the task force that are in North America that are operating under the umbrella under the those organizations. So. The update information in there is from all of them. Anyway, that's a quick sort of hands-on experience. If you want to see, it actually works for this will actually be dual stacked in for V6. And I think that's it. There we go. This is a good resource. Look at that, I'm 10 out of 10. All right? Just some useful info. Sort of a hands-on with a client machine that's actually set up with V6. I'll take my laptop down to the back. If you guys want to come over and ask some more questions, do anything else, happy to answer them for you. Was it useful? Yeah. All right, good. Attend the session on Thursday. There should be some good information because he should be deep diving into like DNS and some other items that I didn't get a chance to really sort of cover.